Accession number 28361, Reel 60.
You were poised for the final assault on the last ring of heights around the canary.
Right. The what actually turned out to be the final assault, but wasn't the final assault as we knew it at the time.
It hadn't been planned to be the final assault.
It hadn't been planned to be the final assault. What was actually the second phase, which was the attack by 5 Brigade on Tumbledown and Mount William, and by my brigade on Wireless Ridge, was meant to be phase two of a three-phase attack. Phase three would have been my brigade on its own.
And I'm developing down from those ridges into Stanley.
Well, around the back of Stanley.
Left flanking or right?
Right flanking, because the left flanking would have taken us through the water. Right flanking, because we were told that we were to try and avoid fighting in Stanley because of the inhabitants. But I'm sure we would have ended up fighting there. So again, that plan would have been theoretical. In fact, I'd given orders for phase three before we did phase two, because I wanted phase three to roll straight on from phase two the next night, and I didn't want to give orders in between. And what happened there was that the phase two kicked off with the Scots Guards attacking Tumbledown. At the same time, two para attacked Wireless Ridge from the north, having hooked around the top of three para who were holding Mount Longdon. And that evening, or early evening, my headquarters was bombed by four Skyhawks. And I think we had been spotted in position, not physically, but by radio intercept.
So this is EW.
EW. Mm. And curiously enough, I'd said we'd been here too long, and instead of doing something about it, which was my fault, instead of moving, I stayed there. Anyway, we were attacked, and we were very lucky, because the headquarters were so well camouflaged that they actually attacked what they could see, which was helicopters parked about 100 metres away from the headquarters, which they comprehensively damaged. And the nearest bomb fell 40 metres away from us. They were dropping 1,000-pounders. Because of the soft peat, we got away with no casualties at all. And we were lucky because I had called an O group to give the orders for phase three, and I had delayed it by an hour, and they bombed at the time we would have been in the O group, and the only damage that was done to the headquarters was to the briefing tent, where all the chairs had their legs chopped off by bomb splinters, and had we been in there, I'd have lost the lot. We'd have all been killed.
Had your legs cut off?
And our legs cut off. Yeah, and more. So we were very lucky. They also bombed a gun position around, didn't do any damage, but their arrival slowed everything down, the preparations for the battle, because helicopters stopped flying, everything sort of ground to a halt, then wound up again.
Did you move the headquarters immediately?
I then started moving the headquarters immediately, and that was actually somewhat disruptive, because what I'd aimed to do was to put the TAC in behind attack headquarters in behind two para. I had to use TAC as the step up to move main, so TAC had to stay more or less where it was. David Chandler's attack was also disrupted by that air attack, in the sense that he was doing his recces, and again everything was brought to a halt while he was doing it, and he had quite another time, but I'll let him tell that story. The attack on Wireless Ridge was highly successful. It was a very good all-arms battle fought by David Chandler, who had a troop of CVRT with him. Now, this was the first time we'd used CVRT in this role, because actually the Wireless Ridge features are sort of rolling, even flatter than Salisbury Plain-type ridges, without all these big crenellated rock ridges. And big sheer drops and so on, so you could use the CVRT. And his attack was very imaginative and was highly successful. I think he had 4 men killed and about 10 wounded, something like that. And by first light, he was on the final objective. And at that stage, I was trying to go and see him, and there was a blizzard, a snow blizzard, which grounded everybody. Incidentally, during the night, the guns had run out of ammunition, and my brigade, our squadron commander, had flown the scout and led the medium helicopters in to the gun positions personally in the night in a blizzard to resupply the guns. Anyway, I was about to go and see David Chandler, who was agitating and saying, I think you've got to come here and see this. And what he was talking about was the Argentine army in full retreat. And I was then summoned to a meeting on Goat Ridge, which is alongside Mount Harriet, with Jeremy Moore and Wilson to sort of mull over what was going to happen next. And at that stage, Tumbledown had fallen, and the Gurkhas were attacking Mount William, and you could actually see them streaming down the side of Tumbledown into Mount William, and the Argentines running away. And there was a certain... Wilson did what he always tried to do, was to try and pull one out over me, which was to say, right, we'll do the next phase. I said, no, we're going to do the next phase. And there was some argument about it.
What, on what grounds did he say?
Well, he said, I had everyone poised ready to go, and he said, well, we'll do it, and he wasn't in any position to do it. And I was originally going to have the Welsh Guards for that phase, and then he sort of pinched them back without telling me. Anyway, having had this rather unsatisfactory conference, I then got in my helicopter.
What did Jeremy Moore say about
it? Well, Jeremy Moore said, no, just let it happen as it's meant to.
So he was saying then that 5th Brigade had had its turn.
It had its turn. In any case, I mean, you know, he had the Scots Guards, quite a lot of cavalry sitting on Tumbledown, the Gurkhas on William, and he was in no position to do the next bit. In any case, his guns had probably run out of ammunition. So I then went round to Wireless Ridge and got out of my helicopter short of the ridge and walked up and stood there, and David Chandler wasn't around, and I was with one of my staff officers, and I was looking at the ground through my binoculars standing there at what was going to be the next bit, and Tumbledown was being shelled by the Argentines, and I could see the shells falling and crunching away on top of Tumbledown, sort of over there. So I thought, well, they're still fighting. And at that point, a voice which I recognized instantly as a sort of sergeant major shouting at recalcitrant soldiers shouted, "The effing war isn't effing over yet. Get off the effing skyline, you effers." And I realized he was talking to me. Of course, standing on someone else's skyline is a very unfriendly thing to do.
Unneighborly.
So I flung myself to the ground and went on continuing looking through with my binoculars, and a pair of boots came up alongside me, and it was David Chandler's voice said, "I think it's over, Brigadier." And I stood up, and I was lying down, and he was standing, which was bad. And anyway, I stood up, and he said, "I've just seen a huge number of Argentine soldiers running away," which were the sort of remnants of people running off Tumbledown and people who were trapped the wrong side, and he'd been shelling them comprehensively. And he said, "I think we ought to get going." And I said, "I agree. I'll get the brigade on the road. You start yourself." At that point, I didn't have a helicopter because it had buggered off, as they do. It then came back. Then the radio on it didn't work. So I then went back to my headquarters and said to my brigade major, "Get the brigade on the road. Get the show." That's all I had to say to him. "Get the show on the road. I'm going back to Tupara. And I and my gunner and his party and my sort of escort and radio operator, we piled back and joined Tupara as they snaked down off Wireless Ridge, started walking into Stanley." And at that point, Jeremy Moore said to me, "Get your brigade on the road." And I said, "Well, I've done that already." There was a moment of slight worry because a big airstrike had been fixed on the Argentines, which A, was now unnecessary, and second, we might walk into it, so we had to stop that, which took a minute or two.
Was this going to be the Harriers delivering?
The Harriers delivering cluster bomb units, yeah.
Cluster bomb.
Yeah, we'd hit them with cluster bombs before, actually, but they're going to do it again. Anyway, we started walking down off the ridge, and then another message came down, just in fact we were still on the ridge, David and I, that there were white flags over Stanley. So we looked through our binoculars, and we all, you know, everyone was standing around that had binoculars. We couldn't see any bloody white flags, and I think it was a figment of someone's imagination. Anyway, we walked in, or started walking in, and another message came through saying you ought to stop everyone at the race course, which is on the outskirts of Stanley, the aim being, or not very far into Stanley, the aim being to allow the Argentine army to disengage and not start butting up against them and start fighting again, as it looked as if they were going to surrender. So unfortunately at that stage the two par had turned off all their radios, probably in anticipation that they'd be given a stop order so that they could pretend they didn't get the order. But they reckoned without the gunners. I turned to my regimental CO and said, are you in touch with the BC forward, with the CO? And he said, yes. I said, well, tell him to stop. So they had no excuse for not knowing. They all filed off and went into defence. And while I was there, Max Hastings came polling up and said, I mean, is this interesting? Do you want to hear this? And said, I'd like to go into the town. So I said, fine, off you go. When he came back about an hour later, he said, can you give me a helicopter to get me back to file my story? So I said, yeah. So I summoned a helicopter and he went back, somewhat agitated that he wasn't going to be first, but he was. And at that stage, I saw a helicopter flying overhead. And I thought, I wonder who that is. It was a British helicopter. I bet it's the divisional commander going forward to negotiate the surrender. And at that time, my brigade was starting to stream in behind me. So I told the chaps to go into defence, you know, told the CEOs where I wanted them to go. And I decided I would go and meet the divisional commander to tell him what I was up to, and to so he knew where we were if something started up again. And so I, taking an escort with me and someone else, a couple of other guys, I walked forward. And it was actually quite strange to be walking forward of one's own lines and then in among the enemy, who were still retreating, who sort of looked at me somewhat oddly. And I took no notice of them. I just sort of strolled on, you know, putting on as British a sort of look as I could, as if it was perfectly normal to be sort of walking among them. And I arrived at what was the Secretariat building under the British administration. And outside it, there was a very smart Argentine officer who I met later, some years later, who I now know is called Major Daglioli, who spoke perfect English and was the Argentine's resident expert on the British and had been sent there to advise Menendez on what the British would do. And I think he was an instructor at their staff college or something. And he, as I say, he spoke very good English. And he said, what do you want? And he recognized my badge, that I was and my rank badge, that I was a brigadier. So I said, well, is my general in there? So he said, no. But two British officers are speaking to my general. So well, I thought, if I go in, I'm not going to add anything to this. I have no right to take part in the negotiation. I've got nothing to add. If I go in, I'll just distract this thing, which I hope is being arranged. And I guessed that the two were Mike Rose and Rod Bell, the interpreter. And that they were doing the preliminary negotiating, setting the thing up.
Negotiating about negotiations.
I mean, you know, Mike Rose doing his sort of SAS negotiator's trick, and Bell doing the interpreting. And so I turned on my heels and walked away, left them, and walked back, and it was then starting to get dark, and my kit was miles away on the other side of a minefield. But at that stage, my brigade major turned up saying, I think you might need me. So he and a few staff had helicoptered forward, and he was much quicker off the mark than me. And he said, I think we need somewhere for the night. So he went to B Company, 2 Para, Johnny Crossland, who was occupying a house, which happened to be one of the few two-story houses in Stanley, and said, can we have a room in your house? So Johnny said, yes. So we all piled into this tiny little room, which is not much bigger than, you know, it was a single bedroom. and the rest of the house was occupied by a company of parachute soldiers, most of whom were asleep, lying on the floor in heaps. And by which time it was starting to get dark, I summoned the COs in to a quick group to sort of say, you know, it's not over yet, make certain you're in decent defensive position. I told them where I wanted them to go, make sure the guns are all loaded and laid on the enemy, and everything's ready to sort of rock and roll in case these guys decide to go on fighting. And Tupara was sort of, headquarters was sort of, you know, in the front line at that stage, more or less. But it was okay, it was a fine place to be. And during the night, but not much later, I mean, it got dark at 4, so we're now talking about 8 o'clock, 9 o'clock, at night, my radio opera with a HF set, because we had HF and VHF, swung his dial onto the BBC World Service frequency and picked up the BBC World Service, and which informed us that the Argentines had just signed the surrender. And about a minute later, Rod Bell came polling in and said, I've just heard this is true. And he said, yes. So I heard about the surrender from the BBC 8,000 miles away, which was taking place 800 metres from where I was standing. So that was a good feeling, actually. And we were feeling quite hungry. We didn't have any of our rations. So we went to the kitchen of this house, which had a peat-fired Rayburn stove. And it had been occupied by the Argentine, obviously an officer's place, because there were all sorts of razors and toiletries and expensive aftershaves and things like that littering the place. And there in the kitchen was a huge pot with some parachute soldiers who had found some Argentine rations, because the Argentine officers didn't lack rations, you know, tins of bully beef and stew and things. They emptied it all into this pot and they were stirring it round. And the company was going through one after the other and feeding themselves. At the end, they said, well, there's some left for you. Would you like some? So we got our spoons out of our pouches, dipped and ate. Everyone was sort of just dipping their spoons into the pot.
Common pot.
Common pot.
All in stew.
All in stew. Common. Absolutely. Brackets. That's it. And someone had also found some plastic bottles of Argentine wine. So we had a quick wet of red wine to celebrate victory. And then the next day, I was sent for by Jeremy Moore and said, you chaps have got to supervise the surrender. So I sent one company down to one end of the town, where the town is joined by a causeway to the airfield. All the troops were being pushed onto the airfield. It was the only way off. It was a road about the width of this room.
The holding pen.
There was a holding pen, and there was nothing to live in. I mean, there were no tents on it. They just had to live in what they had there. And they were disarmed as they went past.
Was this as they were going onto the airfield?
Yeah, as they were going onto the airfield. There were some troops on the airfield already. Yes. They had two battalions on the airfield already. Yeah. And they were pulled off and disarmed and then sent back again. But the bulk of them were still in the town. We were one end of the town, they were the other. Mm. And some of them actually were rioting and looting and behaving in a pretty awful way. So we had to put a battalion in there to sort of sort them out. I mean, not physically, just push them away. And then they started marching past, throwing their weapons, or handing them to people who made safe and threw them on a pile. And there was a moment when the Marine battalion came down in quite good order, and the RSM of 4-2 commander nudged his CO and said, you realize they've still got their colours with them. We'll have those, and they'll hang in the mess. And they obviously must have seen what was in their mind, because they ripped the colours off the pikes and burnt them before we could get our hands on them. He didn't drink the proceeds in wine like the Imperial Guard, but they did burn them. And then, and I'm just telling you, this is to try and create a bit of atmosphere about what it was like. I mean, all our guys were sort of smelly, pretty dirty, unshaved. And the meal that I had with Tupara the night before was the first hot meal they'd had for 72 hours.
Was it good? Were the rations good?
They were not field rations, the Argentine rations, and I'll come back to their rations in a minute. The rations that we found in this house were sort of, you know, tin stuff that you'd find in any sort of any larder, more or less.
Yes.
It was the stuff that they had brought over. It was their stuff, but it was tin stew and big tins like that, and tinned tomatoes and
catering supplies.
And their rations were good. They had good rations. They even had a tot of whiskey in their rations. They had plenty of food. All this nonsense about them starving was absolute rubbish. I mean, on several occasions, my guys, the only meals they had were Argentine meals that were eaten from rations they found on abandoned positions.
Because what was said was that back in Stanley there was plenty of food, but in the front line positions occupied by the Argentinian army, that there was no food.
That's nonsense. I mean,
so that's not true.
That's not true. I mean, I've got numerous accounts, one by Ian Gardner, who was a company commander of 4-5, who said something into the lines of, when they arrived on the next night on Two Sisters, again our packs failed to turn up. It was freezing cold. Had it not been for the Argentine blankets we'd taken and their rations, we would have starved. And they ate Argentine rations. He said they were pretty good. And he said they not only had a tot of whiskey, but they had some cigarettes in them as well. That was nonsense. The other thing that amused me slightly was that we were driving around, my BM and me, in a vehicle. Obviously, it was been a civilian vehicle, a civilian Land Rover, which broke down on the way to the airport. And I was sort of standing there thinking, God, what the hell are we going to do now? Again, he was quicker off the mark than me, because a very smart Mercedes Jeep came past with some Argentine officers in it. And he said, leave the keys in that Jeep, get out and walk to the airfield. and they did, as they were told. And so we got in and drove off. And it makes one realize that when you sort of all the rules are different. You're the winners, and you just take what you want.
Requisition
what you want. And we just requisitioned all that transport and started driving it around. But it was... There's something sort of surreal about it, what a defeated army.
When you were walking in and you were in amongst them, what sort of impression did they make on you?
Well, they struck me as being very sort of hangdog and disinterested. They weren't aggressive in any way. They didn't even sort of say, well, who are you?
But they had resisted quite fiercely.
They'd resisted up to then, and suddenly they'd broken. And there were a lot of dead chaps lying around in the street and that sort of thing. And dead bodies and bits of people, like, you know. But they were, there was a sour smell about the place. Well, the smell of death to begin with, and the sort of smell of peat smoke. And it was, it smelt rather like a rubbish dump. You know, these dumps you pass sometimes where they're burning stuff and there's a sort of rotting smell. Well, it smelt rather like a rubbish dump.
And you were mentioning earlier on the Scots Guards attack on Tumbledown and the Gurkhas on Mount William. Mm. Now, the Scots Guards had some difficulties on Tumbledown, didn't they?
Yes, they did. I mean, John Kisley will have to tell you about it. All I know is what I've heard. Mm. They did, yes. They were up against quite a good lot who were well... And if you walk about on the position, it's a pretty nasty position to attack. It was well defended. They had quite a fight on their hands, and it's a very long, again, this narrow position, which you end up having to attack on a sort of section or platoon front, because there's no point having a company down there, because they're just running up the side of the hill. There's nothing there, and you can push people round, but at night it's bloody difficult to keep control of how far round they've gone or what's happening to them up there. And it's real sort of infantry fighting at its bottom level.
And how did the Gurkhas do on Mount William? Did they have?
Well, the enemy ran away.
The
Gurkhas had their cookeries out. They were going to have some. They were going to collect some heads if they could, but the opposition buggered off wisely.
How close did they let the cookeries get?
Not very close. Not very close. No, it was daylight by then. I could see him coming.
During the run-up to the deployment of the Gurkhas, I can remember that there was there were sequences on the news showing the Gurkhas sharpening their cookeries on grindstones in Aldershot. Do you think that might have had some psychological
impact? I think they did. The Argentines certainly made quite a lot about of it, in the sense that as I recall, they were talking about, you know, it's quite unfair to deploy all these savages, and among the young soldiers, I think there was fear that they would end up having their heads chopped off. Well, and they would have done too.
How was the surrender then arranged with the Argentinians? Do you know how that was?
Well, as I understand it, what happened was that they agreed that they would sign a surrender.
Yes.
But the final details had to be hammered out between General Moore and General Menendez. And so General Moore's flown in. By this time it was dark. It got dark at 4:30. He must have flown in at about 7, I suppose. Or maybe even later. And of course, he had communications direct to Whitehall through Mike Rose's satellite telephone, which is why the BBC got the news before I did.
Yeah.
So he then, as you may want to talk to him about it, are you interviewing him or you don't know? Anyway.
If possible.
He, as I understand it, he's told me about it a number of times, but as I understand it, he went in there, and the only difficulty he had was twofold. It was two difficulties he had. One was that he wanted Menendez to surrender everybody, including the chaps on West Falkland. And he said, well, I don't have control over them. And he said, well, you do, actually. You've got a radio to them, so bloody well tell them to surrender, or we'll come and hammer them. You know, we'll just shell them. But we didn't want to have to do another sort of landing there. And secondly, over the word unconditional, he wanted to have a sort of honourable surrender where he was seen to having some kind of, you know, terms rather than just saying unconditional surrender. So Jeremy Moore thought, he didn't bother to ask Whitehall. He thought, well, you know, why strain as a gnat? So he just put a line through it and signed it out. So on the surrender document, the word unconditional is struck out and signed initial by Jeremy. So then he signed.
Did he actually ask for any conditions at all?
No.
He didn't?
No. He just wanted it to appear that he wasn't being forced into a corner and making it unconditional.
So it was a face-saver.
It was a face-saver. And there's nowhere they could go at this stage. I mean, they'd abandoned their guns, you see. We overran their main gun position. So they had, I think they still had, you know, they had their 155s because they were the other end of town. But we were butting right up against them. And the only place they could go would be, they were totally disorganized. Their battalions were sort of in bits. The only place they could go would be up the causeway and onto the airfield. Well, there were they'd just be in a trap and you'd just starve them to death.
I was going to ask if, you know, when you got onto those ridges on the overlooking, whether they could have made any sort of defence or...
Oh, they could have defended the ridges better. Mm. I mean, Andrew Whitehead, when he got on top of his thing, his objective, he looked back and said, my God, you know, if we'd been up here, I'd die up here. I'd be up here until I was a pensioner if I had to hold this place. They didn't defend them well. They didn't do what we would have done. They didn't put up wire, for example.
Did they put out any mines?
Yeah, they put out mines. Mm. Oh, yeah. But again, in a random sort of way. They didn't mark them properly, you know, with all the proper things you're meant to put up. And the minefield, the mines didn't seem to be any plan to their minefields. There was no, I think, each battalion had sort of put mines out.
But low-level initiatives.
Low-level initiatives. I mean, down to the we were told by prisoners we captured that the chaps in forward positions were issued with these little mines, and they just sort of threw them in front of their trenches, you know, and out into the thing ahead of themselves. And so we didn't actually lose any, we didn't have anyone killed on mines, as far as I know. We had a lot of people had feet blown off on mines. Even afterwards, where we were trying to clear them, because they were so random.
There was no pattern to them.
There was no pattern to them. And my sappers went out for 3 days after the surrender, and on every day they had a man have a foot come on, take off. Every day. And eventually I said, this is it, I'm not going to do this anymore. I went to see Jeremy and I said, this is rubbish. We cannot do this. It's just stupid. Just let's put a wire around where we think they are. You know, make it big so that so it'll take some, and don't let's go on clearing any more mines for the moment. And if we do have to, please send someone out from England who has not been fighting here for the last month and get them to do it, not us.
Could you have required the Argentinian
it's against engineers the, it's to against have, it's against I think it's against the Geneva Convention to force prisoners to mine clear.
Even if they're the ones who put the mines out?
Yeah. You can ask them for their minefield maps, yes. And we did, but they were some use, but not completely use, because the minefields had been laid in three general phases. They'd been the mines laid by the guys who got there when they invaded the place. Then there'd been mines laid by the main body when it arrived over a period of days and weeks. And then there were the mines were laid at the sort of last minute, a day or two before the attacks came in. So there were, and the minefield maps in the early phases were okay. The minefield maps for the sort of middle phases were okay up to a point, and then became out, then became irrelevant. And then the final ones, there weren't any minefield maps anyway, so you didn't really have much information about it.